Pensacola.com.
Yep.
Good morning, Pensacola. It is Tuesday, October 4th. Thank you for listening. We're Real News with Rick Outzen. We have got a full slate of guests today, a lot of hot topics. We've got Commissioner Jeff Bergosh is going to come on. We're going to talk about the Bellevue shooting and what the county and the sheriff's office and the city of Pensacola are going to do to make our ballpark safer. We have Tom Rivers with ABC. We're going to have Quint Studer. Wahoos won their first undisputed championship. And we're going to have him talk about that 10-year journey to that championship. We're going to have Troy Rafferty come on to talk about the Soul Bowl. And a guest I'm very excited about is Elizabeth Eckford. She's one of the Little Rock Nine, one of those nine students back in 1957 who integrated Central High in Little Rock. She's coming to town to speak on Thursday. We've got her. And then we're going to wrap it up with Mary Riker on WSRE, PBS there. Wine and Food Classic. So it's a full show. If you can't stay with us for all of it, go back to the podcast and catch up with it. The biggest story in town right now is what are we going to do to make our ballpark safer? After the incident on Saturday at Bellevue, not too far here from the station, youth football was going on. There was a disturbance at the park. Some of the people left. They came back wearing masks and guns. One man was killed. Another man was injured and put into the hospital. The sheriff's office yesterday called a press conference, and Sheriff Chip Simmons was pretty clear, you know, we cannot let this happen in our parks. He was flanked by Commissioners Jeff Bergosh, Lumen May, County Administrator Wes Marino, Superintendent Tim Smith, and Parks and Recs Michael Rhodes, and we've got Commission Chairman Jeff Bergosh on the phone now. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
This is frightening. It's frightening in that people would be so callous, and as Tim Smith said, evil to do a gunfight with kids right in a ballpark there. And I think the big question is how can we prevent this from happening again? And you had some ideas yesterday. You talked about one thing that both you and Tim Smith talked about very early on was that the school system has offered counseling for the children that were there and their families, and the county's doing something similar, aren't you?
Yes, sir. Wednesday, tomorrow night at 6 p.m. at the Marie K. Young Wedgwood Community Center, we're going to offer grief counseling for any of the witnesses to the event. See, the horrific part of it, Rick, and I'm sure you're aware of this, is this gunfight, for lack of a better word, they shot 15 rounds. I don't know how many times the decedent was hit. I know the other gentleman suffered two wounds. But 15 shots, that's a gunfight. And it's literally feet away from parents, spectators, cheerleaders, you know, players, young kids. And so, obviously, everyone saw the aftermath, blood, gore, you could imagine all of the above. So our thoughts are, you know, a lot of those kids, that's something that's going to stay with them forever. Sheriff Simmons recounted a story about a young lady who didn't want to leave. She was so terrified. So a lot of that's going to manifest itself in these youth that saw this. And so that's, to me, the tragedy. I mean, people don't want to have a gunfight over personal beefs or drug deals or whatever the case might be. You know, that's going to happen. But why? Like you said, why do it in the middle of a children's youth football game? How selfish, how cowardly, frankly, I'll just use that word, and to do that. But so our immediate concern outside of security going forward is going to be, let's get some grief counseling for these children who unfortunately had to witness this horrific thing. This isn't a video game. This is real life.
Right.
And so these kids are going to need help. So we're proud to do that, happy to do that. We're going to add additional security at the remaining seven home games. We went through, we had a big roundtable at the sheriff's office after the press conference. It's all hands on deck. We're going to utilize technology. We're going to deploy drones. I mean, these parks are going to be as safe as we can make them.
Well, and, you know, the other thing that Chip asked for, Sheriff Simmons, was that we know that at ball games, everyone's got their camera, they've got their phones, they're taping what's happening at the game. And he's asked anyone out there that was at Bellevue on Saturday, any part of the day, if you were taping part of the game or you were taking pictures with your phone, you might have caught the people that they're looking for. Not intentionally, but apparently there was a pretty big disturbance, altercation at the field before these guys left and came back with guns. And the sheriff thinks somebody might, maybe not intent, they might have been filming the cheerleaders or a player on the field, but in the background, this may be there. And they're asking for people to come forward with their cameras and download their videos so that the sheriff's office can look at it, because they're still trying to locate the prime suspect here.
Yeah, absolutely, Rick. And as you know, sadly, our culture today, when gunshots go off, instead of picking up your phone to call 911, many people pick up the phone and turn on their camera, which eventually helps investigators. But in the meanwhile, it's not the safe thing to do. It's not the smart thing to do. So we know if there are 15 shots fired, number one, there was a fight first.
Right.
So we know people had the phones out. It's just they're not speaking with the officials. Sheriff is frustrated about that. I'm frustrated. We're all frustrated. If you know who did it, call the police. Do the right thing. But people don't. And then these things continue. This cycle continues. I mean, we see it. We don't see it just here in Pensacola, Rick. And the national media ignores it. Over the weekend in Chicago, 31 got killed, primarily African-American, including the 7-year-old. You don't see it in the national media. It adds up to thousands every year, 2 jumbo jets a month. Imagine if 2 jumbo jets a month crashed in the United States of America. That would be a crisis that would warrant coverage. That's essentially what's going on in our inner cities around the country. And I hate to say it, it's seeping into Pensacola, Florida. So we got to nip it in the bud. We don't want that in our community. That doesn't represent the Bellevue community. And we've got to get a handle on it. And I know the sheriff's doing everything he can, but we need the help of the community. They got to step up. They got to speak up. And if they don't, this is going to continue. And next time it could be someone they love.
Well, we're talking to Commissioner Jeff Bergosh about the shooting at Bellevue Park this weekend. If you haven't heard about it, go to the blog, ricksblog.biz. Big press conference yesterday on it. You know, there's a thread out there, and I want to nip this one in the bud, is there's people out there saying, well, this should be, you know, the ballpark should be paying for the extra security, you know, and that's not fair to the parents and to the kids who are just trying to put on a, you know, let their kids have the joy of being in a team sport and cheer and all those things, and all of a sudden they're having to pay for extra security at an expensive rate. When this is a community problem, and if we'll make it prohibitive to do that, if we have make the parents.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to step over you, Rick.
No,
but
go ahead.
That's a rumor that's out there. You know, right now the parents are paying for either one or two off-duty officers or security personnel at each game, and so the county has stepped in. Myself, Commissioner May, West Marina, we've said we're going to pay to have additional 14 officers over the next 7 home games. So I don't want the parents to have to pay. You're right, it's horrible. When I was on the school board, the high schools, the booster clubs, the quarterback clubs always had to pay for a cadre of off-duty
right.
officers. It's very good work for the officers. They love it. But it is. It's an expense on the parents. And sadly, in our society, in some segments of our society, it's necessary. But it doesn't prevent things. People got to know this. We could have the entire sheriff's office there. It doesn't prevent something from happening. Now, it would certainly lend itself to catching the person quickly, but as we've seen in other places, we recently saw the vice president of, I think it was Argentina, with round-the-clock security all around her, walk into a crowd, the guy put a gun right in her face, pulled the trigger. Luckily, it didn't work. So no matter how good your security is, people can get a target, and they can even get it, especially if it's a soft target. So it could have been worse. I mean, my fear, Rick, that's kept me up at night is, what if one of those young players would have got shot in the head? I mean, it's just inconceivable to me. This is America. This should not be happening on our streets. This isn't a third world country, and we got to get a handle on it. And it starts with the community speaking up about what they know. If they keep their mouths quiet, we're never going to catch them.
Right.
So we need their help. The sheriff needs their help. He said it over and over. We need the community to step up and identify these people.
And this is a time for, I think, to show community unity, to go to the game, show protection at the game, and for the parents,
yes,
for their children to feel safe. Jeff, thank you so much for coming on this morning.
Absolutely, Rick. Have a great week.
All right, you too. Take care. All right, we're going to break, give you traffic, weather, and news. We'll be right back.
This report is...
Welcome back. We are Real News with Rick Alton on WCOA.
This day in 1996, That Thing You Do, the Tom Hanks movie came out. The band The Wonders. Yeah, this song was written by Adam Schlesinger, the bass player for Fountains of Wayne, who also wrote the romantic classic Stacy's Mom Has Got It Going On.
That would have been even better. North Korea apparently has fired a ballistic missile over Japan, and we've got ABC's Tom Rivers with the details. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Yeah, kind of a variation on the theme. We've kind of gotten used to this, some short-range missiles over the about past 2 weeks. This was the fifth in the series, but this one was different. This one was an intermediate ballistic missile, and for the first time in 5 years, guess what? It flew over northern Japan, and that really, really rankled the government in Tokyo. Sirens went off, and people were told to, you know, but stay where you are, shelter where you are. Subway train stopped, mainline rail stopped as well for a short period. 7:20 in the morning, wow, everybody was getting up,
right,
heading out, going to work, etc. So a scary time, something we haven't seen for a few years, going over land in that part of the world.
Yeah, the countries are so close. How much warning did they have that they knew it was coming towards them?
The Japanese are pretty good at that. I mean, they've got a little bit of time. Very, very different with South Korea. They have milliseconds if something was heading in their direction. But yeah, they've been through this before, and they see what they see. And if it does look like it's something coming overhead, they will put the signal out, and the sirens will blare. People know the drill.
Now, the Defense Department from Japan did speak out on it. Have we heard anything from North Korea at all on this?
No, nothing at all. There was some footage released later. And again, we saw some shots of the launch itself. But it's very, very concerning. One, the fact that these can go, you know, further, couldn't potentially hit something like Guam, where there's big U.S. presence there. And of course, you know, these things, you know, don't always go where they're intended to go.
Right.
What if the thing had gone off target, crashed into some city in Japan, and then you got a real story on your hands?
Well, I guess over the rest of the day, we'll hear more responses from countries around the world, you know, about this, speaking out. I'm sure the U.S. government will speak out on it later this morning.
Yeah, they'll speak out on it, but again, nothing really will change. It doesn't really matter who's in power. And in Washington, we've seen a lot of administrations just kick this into the tall grass for years and years and years. But again, we'll hear words, certainly in coming hours, not only from the U.S., but other countries as well. But as to what you can do, that's the rub. That's the real problem.
All right. Tom, thank you so much for filling us in on all this.
Take care.
All right, take care. We're Pensacola's first radio station, wonderful City of Advantages, WCOA, and this is Real News with Rick Outson.
It's October 4th, and on this day back in 1986, newsman Dan Rather was attacked by this guy who kept hitting him and going, "Kenneth, what's the frequency?" So REM wrote this song, "Kenneth, what's the frequency?"
16 years ago, in September, the night the referendum passed for the Community Maritime Park, I was sitting at a Waffle House with Quint Studer and Mort O'Sullivan. We had gone through a very long process of getting that referendum passed, dealt with all sorts of pushback, lies that were told, fights that we had. But we knew that Pensacola was going to change with that vote. And this week, last week, we won our first undisputed championship with the Blue Wahoos, and I've got Quint Studer on the phone. Congratulations, Quint.
Well, Rick, you know, there wouldn't be a Community Maritime Park without you. I mean, your paper and blog was so important because you were able to quickly put out facts when people would say things that weren't weren't accurate. So thank you. What people, we wouldn't have the championship because we wouldn't have a team. We wouldn't have a stadium if it wasn't for you. So thank you.
Well, thank you. But we also wouldn't have it because you don't like bullies. And you were not going to be bullied. That's the kinship you and I have a lot of things. But we both hate to see bullies. And there was a part of this community that was trying to bully us from not having this ballpark. And now, it's kind of hard to find people now who say they weren't for it, isn't it?
Yeah, I got a nice note the other day from someone that said they really were against it the whole time. And now they're season ticket holders.
Yeah.
So it's nice. I think part of life is forgiveness and right. Moving on, and that's a big part of this.
Well, yesterday at the mayor's press conference, he recognized the championship. It was good to see Bruce Baldwin back. He was part of the beginning. Tell us how you got connected with Bruce.
Sure. I had an independent football team called the Pelicans, and the stadium got approved. And I had never been involved in building a stadium whatsoever. So I asked Miles Wolf. In fact, Miles Wolf, for those trivia fans, owned the Durham Bulls when the movie was made, Bull Durham.
Right.
And he started independent baseball. And he was our commissioner. And I called him up and I said, do you know any experienced baseball men that I could have help me? So I hired him as a consultant to help us with the stadium. And then I said, could you go find somebody to run it? I think he walked into the hallway, came back in the door and said, I found him. And it was him. And then he's the one that really helped us get affiliated baseball. We would not have affiliated baseball if it wasn't for Bruce Baldwin, because Mobile owned the rights to Pensacola. And we had to find a team and move a team. And I didn't have any knowledge or history to do that. And Bruce is the one that really made a lot of this happen.
Well, this had to be one of the most complicated deals because, one, you didn't have to do it. You could have stayed independent. The Pelicans, if the league would have stayed together, I mean, you didn't have to go with Major League Baseball, but you did. But I know we don't have an hour, but just in a minute, try to wrap up, because this was a very complicated deal because you couldn't just buy a franchise. You end up having to buy several franchises to make this happen.
Yeah, well, what happened was, first of all, because we were members of the American Association, we had in our agreement that we couldn't just not have a team. We had to find another city to relocate the Pelicans to because they needed a team. So the Pelicans ended up moving to Amarillo, Texas. I actually paid them $300,000 to take the team. And then we ended up buying a team we had to find a team that could move. And it's very difficult. In fact, it's almost impossible today now that Major League Baseball runs minor league baseball. We bought a team called the Carolina Mudcats, who still exists because we let them keep the name and the brand. So we had to buy them to move them down here. And then we had to go to Mobile and buy our naming rights, property rights back, or territorial rights, which was about $500,000, which was the most anybody had ever paid. Nobody paid a premium price because the team was moved. The team was probably should have been worth $10 to $12 million. We paid $14.4 million for it. And then right before we were ready, the owner of the Carolina Mudcats said, oh, by the way, we got to find another team to come replace this team because in my lease it has to be another affiliated team. So I ended up with him buying the Kingston, North Carolina team to move to Carolina. So I think, and then we had a broker involved. So there were five different moving parts all going on at the same time. It's still the most complex deal ever in minor league baseball.
Yeah, and you couldn't keep the Pelican name, so you had to come up with the name, and you had a contest for the name, and you came up with, you know, the Blue Wahoos, and it's that was interesting too because, you know, everybody was trying, well, what. And you were looking for something different with the name. You were looking for something more. Talk about that just a little bit.
Yeah, people sort of go and pick the normal name, like the Admirals. You know, let's pick the Admirals or something. And so the biggest challenge was people trademark these names like crazy because of merchandise. And,
right.
You know, and somebody would write, some of them were sort of, people in Pensacola have a tendency to state things and do it in a very forceful manner. And I would get emails that would say, you know, we're with the Reds, so if you don't name it the Red Snappers, you're an idiot. Well, I know that sometimes you move around, so we didn't know if we were going to be with the Reds more than 2 years.
Right.
Then, of course, we had fun with the Mullets because people just, I wrote, God knows, it said, if you name it the Mullets, it's the most, we'll be the laughingstock of America. You know, like, all these people are paying attention to the name of the baseball team in Pensacola. Anyway, and now, ironically, when we play Mullet Thursdays, it's a popular name. So the name was actually the Wahoos, Rick. And then we sent the Wahoos to Major League Baseball, and they said, you can't use it because you'll be sued. Because the University of Virginia, I think their name was like the Cavaliers or something like that. Their nickname is the Wahoos. So the nickname has a nickname. And that's where we threw blue on the front of it to help us with the trademark issue. But also I liked it. It sort of did a lot of blues there in the area. So, yeah, that was nothing's easy in Pensacola, Florida, Rick.
Well, and it also it's translated because you've been affiliated with three organizations, the Reds, the Twins, now the Marlins. So you didn't have any kind of you were able to keep the same uniforms all the way through. You're able to and have a lot of fun with it. And I think the thing about the Wahoos is that it's the experience that y'all have succeeded in. This might be our first championship, but as far as baseball experience, we're world class here in Pensacola.
Yeah, well, thank you. You know, one of the things I realized, and I think independent baseball really helped me, Rick, because we knew that we weren't going to have. We had one player in 9 years ever go to the majors, Eduardo Ramirez. And so we knew we weren't this funnel to Major League Baseball. And so independent baseball, St. Paul Saves, those types of things, have always been very dependent on the fan experience, just like the Savannah Bananas are the big name right now.
Right.
And basically, and I think that was really helpful. Because what happens with baseball, and we've seen it in other cities, even in Beloit, people think that's their product. Come see people that are going to go to the majors. Well, only about 10% of people come to a game to see people that will go to the majors. So we really focused as good as we could at and UWF as the fan experience. So when we moved to the stadium, I think it's the same thing. We also wanted to create a Wahoo brand, not a Major League affiliate brand. So, yeah, we do a net promoter score, which we do fan experience, and this is the best year we've ever had. So, yeah, that's what you hear, you know, because we get scouts. We get even parents of the visiting players come in. We had one person from Montgomery. They got so gung-ho, they started yelling, go Wahoos, until they remembered their kids on the Montgomery team. So, yeah, we really focus on the experience. We have a great staff and great ushers and great food service people and, so, yeah, that's our focus. People would say, how's the team doing? I said, it's doing real good. Our net promoter score is 92.
For our listeners, this is a voice I know is familiar to most of you. It's Quint Studer. The Wahoos won their first undisputed championship. They had one 5 years ago, but it was weather canceled the championship series that was shared with the Smokies. Talk about just a minute. We got just a couple minutes, Quint, about, you know, the championship itself. This was lost first game, had to win two. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think it really shows the power of Kevin Randall, our manager, and culture. Because we won the first half, we have some really good players in the first half. When you have really good players in the first half, they end up playing with somebody else the second half. I'd say 60% of our team that won the first half, maybe 70%, most of our pitching staff. Roy Johnson, who was named the most valuable AA player by the Marlins, ended up at the AAA. So we had 70 players come through here. So our second half team wasn't near as good on the field in the record as the first place team. But once you get in the playoffs, anything can happen.
Right.
And we lost the first game, both series. We went up to Tennessee and, you know, to tell you how hard this is. Tennessee Smokies, which is a great, well-run organization, last won the Southern League Championship in 1978.
Wow.
So it's not easy. So that's why, and they did an amazing thing. And a great story, Rick, and I know you got a few seconds here, but one of our players in the first game up there hit a double, and I think he was so excited he hit a double. They usually get on second, then they take off their stuff like batting gloves and bat, and they give it to the first base coach, and they call timeout. He stepped off the base, and before he could call timeout, he got tagged out, which was a really big mistake.
Right.
So he didn't come back out on the field. Obviously, the manager didn't think he deserved to come back out into the game. But the manager did something really neat. He started him the second game. Just like, hey, you made a mistake, learn from it, you're back in the lineup. And he hit the grand slam that made the difference. So it's one of those things, Rick. People make mistakes. I think good leaders let them learn from them and then move on, and that's really what they did here. So great compliments to Kevin Randall and the Marlins organization.
Oh, that's so cool. Quint, thank you so much for coming on today. I appreciate your friendship, and it's been a wonderful journey, hasn't it?
it's been marvelous, and to see the fans show up early to put chalk on before the players go out of town,
right. The
number of people that greet them, and that's what we want. We want to create that this isn't our baseball team. This is the community's baseball team. So it's been great to see the people, the Wahoos, become such a popular thing in our community.
Well, great. Quint, have a great week. Thank you for coming on this morning.
All right. I still remember that Waffle House night very well.
Too.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. We'll have Troy Rafferty. We'll be talking.
There's a butterfly hanging around the bluebells and the daisies. There's a lot more love in her. Love to the
sport. Thank you for joining us. We're Real News with Rick Outson.
October the 4th is Leo Barnes' birthday. You probably don't know who that is, but it just reminded me how much I like this band. He was the lead singer and writer for the Hothouse Flowers, a popular Irish band. He was born in Dublin and grew up in an orphanage.
You're right, I didn't know him.
Yeah. I just love this song, though.
We have got one of my favorite events of the fall on October 15th. We're going to have the Soul Bowl. The title sponsor for this event for several years now is Troy Rafferty, and we got Troy on the line now. Good morning, Troy.
Morning, Rick.
Why is this such a big deal for you? Because you've been the title sponsor now for over 5 years.
Well, you know, it's important for a couple of reasons, but mainly it's just once you've gone to one of these, it's really a community event,
mm-hmm.
and it's an incredible opportunity for the community to come together and showcase these kids, you know, out there on the football field at Wahoo Stadium. You know, which is, I know you just talked to Quint Studer on your show, and, you know, I mean, what a beautiful venue that is, and for these youth football kids to be able to run out of the tunnel and, you know, into such a beautiful stadium with all the fans, it's a sight to behold. It's fun. There's all sorts of activities. But mostly it's important because I think it's important that we take every opportunity we can to come together as a community. And this is really one of those opportunities that is, you know, it is just family fun, activities, great football games, rivalry, a good friendly rivalry between the East Pensacola Rattlers and the SYSA Tigers. So it's just a great time.
You know, it's a great experience. You have the cheerleading squads. You've got the kids see their photos on the big screen. It goes all day. The food is great. They've got food outside, vendors outside coming in. The people dress up. They have the entry into the games. The players coming out of the locker room is equivalent of an NFL game. Smoke, fireworks.
Oh, yeah, the smoke, fireworks, everything. It's exciting.
It's
exciting for the fans.
Oh, it is. Yeah, we've got Troy Rafferty, the Soul Bowl. It's an annual event. It's October 15th on Saturday. It is, you know, it's something you can stay there all day. Once you get your ticket, you can come and go if you'd like. But it's also become an event where a lot of the community comes there, because one of the big parts is the Unity Circle. Talk about that, Troy.
Yeah, it's about midway through the games. It's an opportunity for us to all go down. Several people go down, and sponsors and the coaches and, of course, Commissioner May and several others get to go down and form a circle. And we really just kind of, you know, make sure everybody's together. It's a symbol and of what our community is and does. And it's a wonderful thing.
You know, it started because I remember when it was before Wahoo Stadium was built, we had the Sun Bowl was rotated between McGee Field and Legion Field. And part of the reason they created initially was the rivalry is so intense that Lumen felt like we needed to get all the coaches and team moms together just to show the kids that we could be rivals on the football field but still be a community. And it's grown from that to where this is, if you're anybody in the community that care about what's happening, you want to be there for that Unity Circle.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a really, like I say, it's a symbol of what our community is, and that's all of us coming together.
You know, Troy, you and the firm have been big sponsors of SYA Sports and youth sports. You're helping build the Rafferty Center over by the Theopolis May Center. There's a rumor that you are. If we can get Lumen to finally let the contract, we'll have it. But this is your commitment to youth sports. You and Ashley and the firm have really committed to youth athletics.
Yeah, I think, you know, my philosophy is youth athletics play a huge role in the formation of these kids. It teaches them so many valuable lessons. Like you said, even the rivalry, making sure that even though, you know, you might be rivals with somebody, that doesn't mean, you know, it has to be nasty or anything like that. You win with grace. You lose with grace. You know, you talk competition. You talk dedication and hard work, teamwork especially. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I think it's youth sports are an incredibly important tool for the formation and shaping of our children.
It is. And when you look at this event, and, you know, Troy, you and I have gone together several times, and when you look at the adult leadership that's there, the coaches on the sidelines, the parents, it's a lot of good leadership and mentoring's happening on those fields.
Oh, yeah, it's incredible. And of course, none of this is possible without the enormous commitment of many, many, many volunteers who come out there, including the coaches, including the fans, including the people that help put it together, and it's not possible without that. And as you said, Commissioner May is the driving force behind this every year, and it's just the coaches and the volunteers and everybody really are what make this happen. I always say I've got the easy job. I just write the check.
All right. Troy, thank you so much for coming on today. We'll see you at the Sun Bowl.
Thanks.
All right. Take care. We're going to break for national news. When we come back, we'll have Elizabeth Eckford, part of the Little Rock 9.
That's Nicola's first radio station at 1370 AM and now at 104.9 FM. WCOA AM, W285 FY, Pensacola, a Cumulus Media.
Thank you for joining us. We're Real News with Rick Outson on WCOA. On Thursday night, the Equity Project Alliance, in partnership with the Delta Iota Omega Chapter, Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, and the Diocese of Central Gulf Coast, are going to bring Ms. Elizabeth Eckford. She's one of the Little Rock Nine. In 1957, she and her fellow students were the first to integrate that high school. You might remember there's an iconic photo, probably the one of the most iconic photos of the civil rights era, of Ms. Eckford walking back to the bus stop with white students yelling and screaming at her. It's my pleasure to have Ms. Eckford on this morning. Ms. Eckford, thank you so much for coming on the radio.
Thank you. I'm here with my co-writer, Dr. Eurydice Stanley. We're going to be talking about our book.
Oh yes,
the worst first day, bullied while desegregating Central High School. I use the term desegregation because it was never intended that we would be included or empowered in this limited token desegregation plan.
That first day, I've read some of the accounts. You were sort of left out of the group that got the National Guard protection, weren't you, that day in going to school?
The governor had called out the National Guard, he said, to preserve peace and order. And he said that if we showed up at the school, blood would run through the streets. But I had expected that the National Guard would protect all students. I knew that there were demonstrators across the street from the school, but I wasn't frightened then. I walked up to the National Guard after I saw them break ranks to admit white students to the grounds of the school, and they closed ranks when I approached them. And Central has a lot of entrances, so I walked down to where I saw another sidewalk leading to the school. And this time, the soldiers crossed rifles to bar me. I made a third attempt when I walked down to the middle of the street. Central is two blocks wide, and the main entrance is at the center. This time, so a soldier directed me across the street where those angry demonstrators were. When I stepped out into the street, they continued yelling and threatening me. I heard a voice say, "Let's hang her. Get a rope, drag her over to the tree." And other people were threatening my life. So I knew very well the neighborhood. I knew that there was another bus stop at the end of that street. So I headed there. Meanwhile, there were reporters and photographers walking backwards in front of me, and the crowd that was threatening me was immediately behind me, following me. I turned and looked at the crowd because I was looking for help. Right. I saw an elderly woman who had a kind face. As I turned toward her, she spat on me, so I had to continue walking to where I to the next bus stop, which in my mind meant safety for me. I felt that it would be a place where a respite for me. But they continued following me and threatening me. So it was very, very, very frightening.
Gosh.
I probably was in shock. I don't know. But I just could put one foot in front of the other and continued walking. When I got to the bus stop, there were two people who approached me. One was the husband of the president of the state chapter of the NAACP. I recognized him because they had a weekly newspaper, Elsie and Daisy Bates did, and their photographs were often in the newspaper. So I recognized him, but I didn't know him. In my mother's absence, I called her the Queen of No. And she was very, very protective of all of the children. And I knew that I wasn't supposed to leave and go with any stranger. And this person was not known to me or my family. I had not had any contact with the NAACP. Also, people think that we were an intentional group. Originally, 85 students signed up to go to Central when we were told during spring of 1957 that Central would be desegregated the following fall. The superintendent intended a very small group, so he asked the principal of Dunbar Junior High and the principal of Horace Mann Senior High to discourage a lot of the students. and he said that he would make the final decision as to who would be selected. And he further said that those selected could not participate in any extracurricular activities. When students found out about this, the numbers got smaller and smaller. I'm going back to the people that walked up to me. I told you that I didn't leave with L.C. Bates. But the second person who walked up to me was Terrence Roberts. I had gone to school with Terrence. I recognized him, and I knew that he lived within six blocks of the school.
Mm-hmm.
But he asked me to leave with him. I refused because I felt like after leaving Terrence at his home, I would have 28 blocks to walk by myself. I knew how to get home by walking. So my sister and I had done it when we were in junior high school, and we had used our bus fare to buy donuts and happily walked home those 28 blocks. I was more frightened of what might happen to me if there were fewer witnesses out there on the street seeing me walking and the possibility of being attacked.
Yes.
So I continued to wait at that bus stop, and it was a very, very, very long wait. And people kept threatening me. Suddenly, I heard a woman confront the crowd and said that they should be ashamed that she wanted her little girl to go to school with Negro boys and girls. This infuriated them, and the roar became louder. Just a minute, I'm going to put Dr. Stanley on the phone
okay.
so she can join us.
All right. Elizabeth, thank you so much for sharing this.
Hey Rick. Hi. She just wanted me to share with you where we were going to be.
Okay, please.
We are, first of all, we would like to thank Dr. LeSharon Wiley and the Equity Project Alliance for all that they've done to bring Ms. Eckford there, and I personally would like to thank you as someone who I approached several years ago.
Yes, I remember
in
that.
An effort. Yes, you were supportive of us bringing Ms. Eckford here, and we had, if you remember, she was supposed to be coming the Wednesday after the world shut down due to the pandemic.
Right.
Yes. So I just thank you and to all the partners that will be sponsoring this event. It will be held Thursday the 6th at Pensacola State College at 5:30 in the Ashmore Auditorium. And again, I'd like to thank Dr. Wiley and Sarah Bridget for working so hard to make sure this happens. And I just encourage Pensacola to come out. This will be Ms. Eckford's last year of speaking. And since I lived there for, 11 years, I always wanted to share her story with my Pensacola family. And now is the opportunity.
It is. And this is an amazing story. And, you know, you and your daughter wrote a book with Miss Eckford. I know you're a proud mama. Brag about your daughter just a little bit.
Thank you, Rick. You're my favorite human being for that. My daughter is a sophomore at SAMU. She is doing well. She made the dean's list in the spring. She is an allied health major. She's a double major, allied health and theater with a minor in psychology. And she is a fifth generation Rattler. And she actually does a lot of poetry and spoken word. And The Worst First Day is actually written completely in prose, which makes it an easy reader. And it's filled with images from the era as well as drawings. We commissioned an artist to draw Elizabeth's memories because, like the the youth from Pensacola who desegregated the lunch counters, you cannot find a picture of any of the students from Pensacola who desegregated those lunch counters.
Right.
And it's a travesty. No one wanted to see it. And the same thing happened to the Little Rock Nine. There are no images of them being attacked, the brutal attacks that they received on a daily basis. So this was our opportunity and our way of showing and sharing what happened to Elizabeth.
Right. We've got to keep this history alive because there's so many
lessons. We have to.
I agree.
We have to. I'm going to give her back to you, but we just wanted to say thank you again to the Equity Project Alliance. And everyone, please come out Thursday, October 6th at Pensacola State College at the Ashmore Auditorium, and we'll see you there at 5:30.
All right, Eurydice, thank you so much.
I'm back, Rick.
All right.
You know, the story of the Little Rock crisis is a story of the consequences of silence and inaction.
Right.
I remember when I was sitting there and those people were heckling me, the crowd would shift, and four local reporters sat behind me to be a human barrier so that people couldn't hit me from behind. At the bench, there were two education writers from the Washington Post and New York Times. They tried to comfort me. I remember one said, "Don't let them see you cry." And when a white man put his arm across my shoulder and comforting me, the crowd started spewing the hatred and vitriol towards them. It was so horrible.
Oh, gosh.
And I seemed like I had an interminable wait for that bus.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine.
Directly across the street, there was a drugstore. I got up and walked over intending to call a cab. And they locked the door before I could get inside. So I had to go back and sit and wait and hear this hatred and the threats. Eventually a bus did come, and that woman who had confronted the crowd and said that they should be ashamed got on the bus with me. Two teenage boys tried to get on the bus. She kicked them back. The driver slammed the door and drove away quickly.
Gosh.
So that within a few blocks, I was able to reassure Mrs. Lawrence, the woman who had come to my aid, that I would be all right. I was going to see my mother. And so I had a safe bus ride back to my neighborhood and back to where my mother worked.
Yeah, Ms. Eckford.
But, as I was saying, my experience taught me the power of language and what it is like when people turn away or just become bystanders and don't acknowledge what is happening. One of the things I try to do in talking about the oral history, I try to impart lessons about what people can do, what ordinary people can do. I never ask them to try to defend someone who's being harassed because that can be dangerous, but I ask them to treat other people in the same way they want to be treated.
Mm-hmm.
If you can support someone who's being harassed, it would give that person a moment of hope. So we talk about what it feels like to be set apart, how powerful it is when you have some support, and the lessons from Little Rock, how it affected the city when the only voices heard were the voices of opposition. Had a tremendous impact, not only on the city, but also on the state.
But on the South, it had across, you know, I was born in 57. I was born in 57 and saw, you know, in my lifetime have seen the South change very, but painfully, slowly. But that act of you going, trying to get into the school and desegregating the school
mm-hmm.
motivated a lot of us. A lot of our families, a lot of our parents, to step up and to speak out. So thank you so much. And I'm so excited about you coming to Pensacola. I think this
Thank you for helping us get the word out.
Well, and happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
That's something I tend to forget.
Well, you know, you have only so many 39th birthdays. So
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But thank you so much for coming on this morning.
Alrighty.
All right. Bye-bye. Take care. Fantastic interview. I just wanted to let her talk because no one can tell her story better than she can. Elizabeth Eckford, you're going to want to listen to this podcast and save it. We're going to break for news, traffic, and weather. We'll be right back. Thank you for joining us on Real News with Rick Outzen. We're WCOA, wonderful city of advantages, 1370 AM, 104.9 FM. WSRE PBS Wine and Food Classic is back. We've gone through COVID, and this is going to be bigger than ever this year. And we've got Mary Riker to give us the details. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning, Rick. Isn't it wonderful? There's like all these festivals are back.
Oh,
we have Studio Amped back going on this week. And the Wine and Food Classic is back, and that's our signature fundraiser. And I really enjoyed your conversation with Ms. Eckford. What a gift it is to have her in our community to share her story. And there's a little segue to that. Kim and Julia McQueen are our honorary co-chairs for the Wine and Food Classic, and Dr. Wiley, LaSharon Wiley, is our past board chair and on our board. And one of the things I learned from her was that the Hive program at Innisfree Hotels, kind of sparked the Equity Project Alliance. So their, their values and contributions to our community, Parent University, I think that was an idea of theirs that took off here, kind of aligned with our educational and cultural mission at WSRE. So we're really proud that they've lended their support to this event and our honorary event chairs. And we hope a lot of people turn out at the Ashmore on Thursday for Ms. Eckford because we need to hear those stories while we still can firsthand.
Gosh, yeah, we were just, Cena and I were talking during the break, just the courage and bravery and just the loneliness of dealing with a wall of hate. And it's nowhere to hear it in her words, her tell the story. I think for people that if you're able to go Thursday night, it's an amazing story. Of one person trying to make a difference, just trying to go to school. So thank you, Mary. But let's talk about the Wine and Food Classic, because right. We've got it back. It's bigger than ever this year.
October 15th. Actually, we have two events, October 15th and 16th. October 15th is our big event. We're going to use the space at the SCI building on Garden Street. The plaza out in front of the building is going to be lovely. We're going to have great weather like we have right now, I am sure. So it's outdoors from 6 to 9 p.m. And this year we're celebrating Hispanic heritage. So we have a Latin American Caribbean cuisine themed event. We've got 13 local chefs. I probably use up all my time naming them all, but we have some, familiar chefs like Chris Tingle from McGuire's, Josh Warner from The District. We've got Jason Duckworth from Seville Quarter, Manuel Rodriguez from Innisfree Hotels. You might know him from Redfish, Bluefish. But anyway, we've got those regulars. We also have some new chefs. We've got a Chilean restaurant, a Caribbean, a Puerto Rican restaurant, and a Mexican food caterer joining us. That's Jose Perez, Patricia Rojos Figueroa, and Jennifer Lowry. So we've got a little bit of Caribbean and Latin American authentic flavor, all of our other chefs are going to put that twist on whatever they're serving, and it's a competition. So when you come, you'll have the opportunity to vote for your favorite dish. We'll count up the votes and have a Best Chef Award and a People's Choice Award. And judging for the Best Chef Award will be our honored guest, Alejandra Ramos. She is the host of The Great American Recipe. It's a new cooking competition show premiered this summer. You can stream it now, but it broadcast this summer, and they're in season 2 production right now, so it's been renewed for another year. And that show focuses on the kind of multiculturalism of American cuisine. It was really a lot of fun. I encourage you to stream it if you didn't catch it on the air. And so that's 6 to 9 p.m. on a Saturday night, October 15th, downtown at the SCI building. Tickets are $50. you know, this is our signature fundraiser, so please support this event.
Right.
You can get your tickets at eventbrite.com, or you can just go to our website, wsre.org/WFC for Wine Food Classic.
It's a Studer Community Institute. It's $50 a ticket. It's food, music, cocktails. This is sort of a who's who, one of these type of events that people want to be seen at and be a part of. And then you're adding the brunch component. Let's talk a little bit about the brunch.
Yep. So the brunch is Chef Brian Kadirovic from Kingfishers.
Yes.
I love Kingfishers.
Yes.
But he has stepped up to prepare a brunch on Sunday, a Sunday brunch. It's from 11 to 1. We're going to hold it at the Museum of Commerce. And Alejandro Ramos will be there as well. And it's a little bit higher ticket. It's $100 per person. Our sponsors will be there, but we have about 30 seats we can fill. So if you'd like to attend that, everyone will get a copy of the Great American Recipe Cookbook that came with the show this year. It's got all the recipes from the show, which are amazing. And so that's what's going on Sunday. Those tickets are $100, also at eventbrite.com or through our website. And I want to give a shout-out to Republic National Distributing Company.
Right.
They, for years and years and years, they have provided all the beverages. So we'll have red wine, white wine. Josh promises me some signature cocktails, maybe some mojitos. I know they have a rum sponsor this year, Zaya Rum. And then we'll have bubbly at the brunch, compliments of Republic National Distributing Company.
Oh, great.
And, so it's going to be – we're excited to be back. We're working really hard. There's a lot of details on putting together an event like this. We're really excited to have it downtown. I think it's just a beautiful venue, and I see more and more events are being held down there. So it's, you know, a great, great space for our community, and we hope everybody will come out.
It's a celebrity event. It is a fundraiser for PBS, which is critical. WSRE is critical to our community. It is our community TV station. And Mary, thank you so much for coming on this morning.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and we look forward to seeing everybody on the 15th and 16th. All right, bye-bye.
Bye. All right, man, we went through a lot. We'll be back tomorrow.